I'd like to do a, seems high. Just wanted to go into a kind of context of the way the practice unfolds classically. But then these karmic knots, we call them karmic knots, but sometimes we just kind of get either subtly or kind of like a steamroller, we get hit by these very deep emotional knots. And I just wanted to give it a little bit of framework for you. Does that sound okay for you? Okay, okay, good, good. Oh, good, yay. You deserve it, Ted. So, for example, when you're doing the classical Vipassana practice and the mindfulness practice, they're very clear insights into the nature of our human existential predicament that are inevitable to happen. And the reason we say inevitable in that if you really do apply the mindfulness with some continuity, and sometimes I think we think well, that has to be all day, but if there is that ability to drop the attention into the non-conceptual, connect the attention with concurrence, just with what's happening as it's alive, as it's moving, sitting, walking, eating, that inevitably we will have an insight into impermanence, for example, insight into anicca. And that on a deep level, we see that, as I said this morning, if we notice an in-breath, when we start to notice the out-breath disappear, there are times the insight is that we understand the nature. It's like Vipassana is all about understand the nature of existence, of whatever takes birth, whatever appears, whether it's on a very molecular nano level or on a very macro level, for example, the life of the earth or the life of our body or the life of a galaxy, life of a tree, the life of a breath or a sound or a thought or an emotion. It's like however you look at life and aliveness. Aliveness means birth, life, death. So that insight into that, it's not an intellectual insight. It's not coming from figuring it out through the thought process. It's coming from dropping the attention into the direct experience, non-conceptually, and the experience will feel more like a aha, aha, you know, oh, right. And then, of course, at some point we reflect on it conceptually, or we wouldn't be able to integrate it. But in that, the purity of that practice, when you drop into that non-conceptual level, we encourage you to stay in there as long as you can, because ultimately it doesn't last that long. And you come back up into conceptual all too easily. And if this was a, you know, when we switch to the Vipassana retreat, of course we'll be going into these more deeply and profoundly, but when we say, we'll repeat it over and over again, metta is love infused with wisdom. This is what we mean by infused by wisdom. The kindness is infused with understanding the nature of how things are. So when we say, may you be safe and protected from inner and outer harm, for example, inner harm is considered to be identified, for example, with the hindrances with sleepiness, restlessness, aversion, attachment, or doubt, for example. Or may you be safe and protected from inner and outer harm means that the safety is the deep understanding. So when we practice these over years, our understanding of what the metta means will deepen. The understanding of, the deeper you go in your understanding in the Vipassana practice will be the depth, the depth of the metta will be dependent on the depth of the wisdom. So anicca, impermanence, dukkha, as Steve was saying, it's a great word. the translation is often suffering. It can. What's most important is to see that the insight into dukkha is dependent on our understanding of anicca or impermanence. So the more you understand impermanence, the more you understand that experience is unreliable. It makes sense. Living in a world where experience isn't reliable or dependable is what dukkha means. And then anatta. Atta means self, a separate self from everything else. Anatta means that there is no separate self, and sometimes that is translated as emptiness. The description of it as being uncontrollability is my favorite because it. You know, it so follows that because everything's impermanent, everything's unreliable, it's also not controllable. There's a book called I Am That with translations of question and answers with a teacher named Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, who is no longer alive. And the translator was so exceptional, and he had such deep practice that the Dhamma that comes through is amazing. And he was the one who said, "Love tells me I'm everything. And wisdom tells me I'm nothing. And between the two, my life flows." That's the great paradox. But how beautiful to say, "Between the two, my life flows." And in that part of the book, he said that your true home is nothingness. But he describes that very uniquely. He said that what he meant by that is that it's the nothingness is an emptiness of all content. And that for him, that empty means, I love this, uncluttered by memories and expectations. So he described that home as being like the happiness of open spaces. So when you hear wisdom tells me I'm nothing, culturally we tend to go, oh. We hear love tells me I'm everything, and we're usually like, yeah, right? It's like, that sounds great. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing, we're not sure we aspire toward that, right? It's, you know, because it's not a cultural norm. But to hear it as something like the happiness of open spaces and uncluttered by memory or expectation, it sounds wonderful. You know when you really clean up a room and you like put everything away and you know it's just like you know it's going to be back to the old way within a day or two, but it's all put away, it's all clean. That's what he's talking about. So the Brahma Vihara practice is mostly orienting toward love tells me I'm everything, except you see every day you need the Vipassana. Every day you're going to need that support of wisdom because you hit these knots and barriers and obstacles. And sometimes they're between yourself and yourself. And sometimes they're between yourself and other people. And sometimes they're between yourself and how the universe is designed. So the other way to describe when those obstacles feel really difficult is I like to give the description of a nautilus shell. In the international section of the Honolulu airport that I'm rarely in, but this year on my way to Burma, I was in that room again. They have a really huge cross-section of the most beautiful nautilus shell. And I look forward to seeing it so much. It's almost like if I ever have to stop flying international, I'm going to ask for a special permission to go into this room because it's so inspiring to me. And I just love looking at just like the beginning of this being and how tiny and wound, it's so wound up. And it's going round and round, and then slowly it starts getting space, but it's still circling around the same thing over and over. And then, you know, it's just the space gets bigger and bigger. This is the meditation practice we're doing. And if you're at it long enough, you cannot avoid the feeling sometimes where you're like, I can't believe I'm going through this again, you know, like, and that's how you distinguish a karmic knot. And you'll hear it if somebody asks a question, you'll hear one way or another, you hear this poisonous disdain. It's like, I'm still going through this, you know, and it's like, and then there's often like, and I've done 40 years of meditation and 35 years of therapy, and I've done Qigong, and I've done, and I'm still going through this, you know, and it's like, karmic knot, right? It's like, karmic knot. Karmic knot, why? Because it's your teacher this lifetime. Going to teach you everything about anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Guess who's in charge? The karmic knot. Teaches you everything about not being in control. You're not in control of that. It has its own mind. It's going to unfold in its own way, and it usually comes up when you don't want it to. It just doesn't have good timing. Like, why now? Why when I'm eating this banana in the dining room? Why can't it be when I'm in bed, right? Like, it just has poor timing. But I can assure you that it usually comes after the good stuff. You just you'll trace it after a while. It's like you'll have what we call a good sitting. You know, I don't mean it as a good sitting, but we think of it as a good sitting. It's when it feels like everything is coming together, or almost everything has come together, and it feels like, oh, finally. And it's like there's enough concentration in this practice. There's enough metta, compassion, whatever it is. There's a feeling of kind of getting more immersed, even if it lasts a second or two. That is what I've described again and again as that warm, soapy water. And eventually, it might be 5 days later or 2 minutes later, you might hit the knot. And then it'll feel like you're a bad yogi, bad practice. You can't like sit and walk like you usually do. And it's like, oh, doubt, why did I come here? I should have gone on that vacation. You know, it's just like anything but this. And this is when we tell people to, you know, take a walk, spend some time at the beach, get some tea. And it's everyone's different. So for some people, it's really about finding a place of safety. And if it's in here, great. If it's in your room, lying down, I mean, I think that sense of like, I love when that feeling comes and I'm like, okay, under the covers, time to go under the covers for a while, right? But that might not be what suits you. What suits us in these places is feeling safe. And then we can go through whatever it is we need to go through. And the younger what comes up is for us, the more permanent it feels. And what's so important with these things, and we often forget, but it's not just with these deeper knots, but with it's like, how many of us can notice the end of anger? Right? It's like we might be able to notice the end of the sound of a bird or the end of the sound of the breath, but did we notice the anger disappear? Probably not. But I would encourage you with something like fear or sadness or loneliness or any of it, it's like, even if you notice that it disappeared 2 hours later, take note. It's impermanent. Really important. And see, that's the wisdom part again, to understand the hardest stuff we go through. It's impermanent, and it's, we say it again and again, it's the resistance to it that's so painful. And when finally we go, oh, maybe I love it, maybe I could try accepting this, right? That's like, wow, a revelation. And that's when you know it's going to move. It's the resistance that keeps it dead. It keeps it encrusted. And when that resistance softens, it's alive, like a breath or a cloud. It will move. The critical thing here is that how do we relate to it if it comes back? And this is about freedom, not about getting rid of anything. And with a karmic knot, wow, we just want to nail it and just get rid of it. So when it comes back, there's the resistance again. It's usually merciless. And then we have all this self-hatred and doubt because we thought we got rid of it. And it's like we can't see. With a karmic knot, it's so hard to see that freedom is getting a better and better relationship with it, not getting rid of it. I had a goddaughter in Honolulu some years ago that got leukemia and died. She was 9. It was really hard. And one of the times that she was going into chemo with her oncologist, she said to the oncologist, "You know, this would be really interesting if it was happening to someone else." So wise. That's how your karmic knot is. If it was happening to the person next to you, you'd be like, "Oh, it's okay. It's impermanent, no problem." You know, it's like, why are you so resistant to this thing? You know, because like you're not resistant to that. It's like our karmic knots are unique. We had a friend that he still is a cardiologist, and he came to visit us in Honolulu. And you know, they're usually kind of tough, right? Like tough cardiologists. They make it through their residency. It's pretty tough. And Steve grew up in this area that you walk out to these rocks along the cliffs, and there's a path that it's kind of steep along the cliffs, but I've never seen anybody have a hard time with it. And we took him down there, and he was like terrified. You know, it's just like he just couldn't even go down there. And I was like, wow. Like, you know, I just had never seen the side of him. And so his wife said to me, "Well, why don't you take him to a little less scary place?" And I said, "Okay, Steve, we'll take him to the bamboo forest." You know, which in my mind, the path is about as wide as this hall. Like, it's like, you know, a no steep anything. And we started walking up the path, and he's like, "Are these switchbacks?" And I'm like, "Well, kind of like switchbacks, but not like on a, you know, we're not mountain climbing. It's almost like highway, you know, but it is going to go back and forth a bit." And he said, "I'm not going." And, you know, Steve and I were like, wow, like, you know. But that was his, he was afraid, right? And so when we were driving home, I said, "How about we set up some chaise lounges in the backyard and you read a book?" And he's like, "That sounds really good." That was his karmic knot. And for some people that are really athletic, and that would be really easy to judge. But as I started to get to know him in this way, it was like, wow, this is mindfulness. It's the intention to understand rather than to judge. Always, always, no matter what is going on, who it is, you just never know with someone else. We had a friend in the area where our land is on the Big Island when we first went out there. And Steve had to do a lot of community meetings. And there was one very intense man who was against the project we were doing in the community. And we didn't know him, but it turned out he was against everything. And one time I was walking into the post office and he like slammed the door in my face, and it was like, wow. And we knew this very local man that had worked in the sugar cane his whole life. And we were visiting with him. And everyone else, they were just so angry at him. Really angry at him. And it was easy to be angry with this person. He was so difficult. And this man was sitting with us, and eventually this person came up in the conversation. We were hearing it, other people were talking about it. And he just said seven words, very quietly, "I wonder why he does that." And he had no interest in talking about it because we didn't know. It wasn't a question to be answered. It was a question that remained a question in the community for years and years. No one ever knew, but it was so compassionate. It was just like, "I wonder why he does that." So pure, so liberating. So if anything's bothering you, you can even, sometimes we can say that about ourselves. "I wonder why I do that," right? Maybe we don't know, you know? It's okay if we don't know. The other day, I was talking about that we're born into this existential predicament, which is being born into a body that's extraordinarily vulnerable. And the Buddha called the six sense doors the six sense sensitivities. So it's the sometimes it's the eye door, but it is often translated as the eye sensitivity, the ear sensitivity, the nose sensitivity, the tongue sensitivity, the body sensitivity. But the mind door is so sensitive. I mean, it's boundless. It perceives boundlessly. It can send metta or receive metta, abide in metta boundlessly. That's infinite. What kind of instrument is this that we can perceive thought, that we can be mindful of sound, the speed of sound, the speed of light? Thought is traveling far faster than the speed of light. You know, we wonder why it's hard to be mindful. We give ourselves such a hard time. It's very important to like get a grip on what is actually happening, which is this we are born into this exquisite instrument. Exquisite. And the mind-heart door is beyond fathoming. So that if you ever feel vulnerable, you know, that often the cultural training is to have aversion to it. My training was really to have aversion to being vulnerable. And we're often running from it or pretending we're not. Or we can be identified with it, like it's my vulnerability. You know, when the heart is open and it's soft, it's like it's mine, but it isn't. It isn't ours. That's when you get that love tells me I'm everything. The heart mind includes everything. It can't possibly be ours. Those of you who were born in British Columbia, or at least Canada, are fortunate to have Emily Carr, her paintings as well as her writings. And this is from her book, The Book of Small. Just to explain, The Book of Small is some essays about her childhood in the woods of British Columbia or seashore, growing up around Victoria and outside of it, and her memory and descriptions of what it's like to remember what it was like to be a child here is beautiful. So this is just a short line about the forest. The smell of the earth was rich. The pines and the cedars smelled spicy. The wind mixed all the smells into a great grand smell that made you love everything. The sense door of smell is so powerful. It's supposed to be the last sense door that lasts as we're dying. And we know it's like there can be such a range of even just, it's so evocative, smells. I know for me, the smell of the apple flowers, the apple blossoms, is so evocative of my childhood. And then this one is more leaning toward the vulnerability, but she's describing going up a stream, river. There was so much to see as we went up the river, and we went slowly, because there were so many things to get over and under. Sometimes there were little rims of muddy beach pocked with the dent of deer hooves. Except for the stream, the place was very quiet. It was like the stillness of a bird held in the hand with just its heart throbbing. I think of the Brahma Viharas like that. That it's just like your heart center, it's just like holding a bird with its heart throbbing when it gets quiet and there's that quiet abiding. So I was going to try to talk about opening and closing, but really it's I was kind of already talking about it, which is that this heart center, mind door, and our bodies, as they get more open, we get a better view of how resistance closes the heart, and that it's a protection, and that it's really something to honor and value and respect rather than to judge. So that if your system is telling you, actually, no, I don't want to feel that right now. You can check, you always check to see, is that helpful in that moment or not? But if it's strong, it's so important in terms of a relationship of trust with yourself to honor it. And you see, if you try to override it, it's like usually because of striving. It's because of aversion or attachment. It will be motivated by aversion or attachment, because what's the truth in that moment? The truth in that moment is that your system is saying no. And there are plenty of other ways to be in the present moment, particularly with the no. It's just letting your system say no, and then you find something else to be with. This brings great happiness. It does. It's like, it's incredible. When you feel like that's good practice, you're on your way. When you feel like you have to get to the bottom of everything and be with you know, what you think you're supposed to be with. But as I've been saying, there's a hidden object. And when you feel like the practice isn't working for you, you can be sure that you're trying to be with something that's already gone. Maybe the fear was there 2 seconds ago, but if the resistance is there 2 seconds later, the fear is gone. And we're trying to be with something that actually isn't true. And so if you start shifting to the teaching of the Buddha, where he said, joy is the gateway to enlightenment. Joy is the gateway to awakening. Here it is. Because joy is the deep delight in the truth. And if the truth is resistance, can we have a deep delight in it? We can. We can honor it. We can respect it. And then our system will trust us. The truth is also that we have mixed motivation. And there are times when we will have an agenda, like getting rid of the resistance, you know, or we'll have an expectation, or, you know, that you come in to sit and you go out to walk and you think, well, you want the great sitting you had 3 hours ago, or you want the walking you had 5 days ago. That's the agenda. That's the expectation. That's the attachment. And rather trying to go no or to avoid it, just see if you can go, you know, ha, 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 ha. You know, of course, it's okay. Of course I want that sitting back. Who wouldn't? Of course I want that walking back. Who wouldn't? But then it's like coming back to what is, not what we want to get. Over and over, it's what is, not what we want to get. What is, it erodes the unhealthy self-centeredness. The unhealthy self-centeredness is, I want what I want when I want it now. And it's not in harmony with the nature of how things are. Even when you look at energy, energy goes up, energy goes down. Energy goes up, energy goes down. And we battle it, and we battle it, and take it personally. And when you accept it, it's so much easier. It's so much easier. And we only battle it because we think it's mine. So this is, again, where the wisdom practice, it just inevitably has to support the Brahma-Vihara practice. So it's okay if striving appears. It's okay if an agenda appears. In fact, again, it's like, of course. But then you see that you don't have to be a victim of it. You don't have to be oppressed by it. You can just recognize it. And if you do, it'll come and go. And you can start again. You just start again. But it might not be what you want. And this is where joy and mudita, they come together, the practice, because there's this saying, there's a translation for begging bowl in Japan that I love. The translation for begging bowl, the monk's begging bowl or nun's begging bowl, is just enough. And you can't hear this enough. The Buddha taught that in the human mind, in everyone's human mind heart, there's a stream of dissatisfaction. He called it an army of Mara. There's 10 armies of Mara. First is hunger, second is thirst, third is dissatisfaction. And Mara is the killer of existence. I would call dissatisfaction the killer of connection. And it's like when you look at how we relate to ourselves, so much of it is that we're not good enough, we're not worthy, we're worthless, because we buy into this dissatisfaction that's just the way the mind is. And you'll hear it, it's like, you're sitting and there's this judge. Well, you know, if you heard the commentary, if you heard everybody's commentary in here, you'd get it. It's universal. It's not, you know, it's not your own unique. Well, it could be a little bit, you know, it was much better 4 days ago. How could it be so much worse now, right? Whatever we do, we just, you know, almost constant, it's not good enough. But what the Buddha said is that that's how the human mind is. So what do we do with that? Well, you learn to say, no, it's just enough. It's just enough. I think the begging bowl is so brilliant. That book, Cinderella and Her Sisters, one of the things the Ulanovs say, Barry and Ann Ulanovs say, is that gratitude is dependency acknowledged. And so when you take a breath, are you grateful for air? But we don't want to acknowledge how dependent we are on air, or how dependent we are on water, or how dependent we are on kindness. Babies die if they don't get enough kindness. They die. If you're alive, you got enough. Really, it's like, you know, we might not have gotten as much as we wanted, but we got enough to be alive. So when you get your meal, for example, that it's clearer, you know, is that enough? It's like just enough. And then try to have a spoonful of food and taste it, swallow it, and that spoonful is just enough. Or just standing up or taking a step. It's like this is the shift. It's why we slow down. The shifting is that we cut through that oppressive thought process. It's like the thought process can be almost one continuous stream of dukkha. And it isn't personal, but we have to be careful of buying into the comparing, the judging. It's just comparing, it's just judging. And try to remember it sometimes. It's just enough. It's just enough. So whatever you get in your begging bowl for the day, whatever your day was like, it was probably plenty. And the next day you go to bed, and there is a great, great way of being, counting your blessings. It sounds old-fashioned, but it's really helpful. If you count your blessings every night when you die, just before you die, you'll be good at it. And it's a really important way to die. People wait too long. If you wait till the 10 seconds before you die, you're not going to be that good at it, right? You know, it's like, this is why we practice. And this is, it sounds simple, but it's transformative. The new regime. I like to bring up these great books that come out of British Columbia. A Story as Sharp as a Knife is another one, which is the translation of Haida oral literature. And it is by Robert Brinkhurst. And it's classical Haida oral literature from the island Haida Gwaii. And there's a man named Swanton. I'm not sure I wrote his whole name. John Swanton. He was educated at Harvard, and he was sent by the anthropologist Boas there in October 1900 to come up to Haida Gwaii and copy down the stories. And this is what Robert Brinkhurst wrote about John Swanton. He, by the way, Swanton spent 3.5 years in Haida Gwaii writing down the stories from the great old storytellers, word for word. He said that he came wholly unprepared, yet perfectly equipped. He stepped into a world in which dogfish and geese and killer whales are bearers of the heart's truth. If you have any connection to nature at all, you will love that. That any tree or anything you love in nature is the bearer of the heart's truth. As potent agents of creation, guides and escorts through the maze of space and time. And I hope you can take that in, because when you're having a difficult time and you need connection, hopefully you will find it. It's like something comes alive. It saves our life. And it's only through that understanding that we will keep trying to care for the earth and protect the earth, because the earth is our body. So getting back to gratefulness, it's like Vipassana practice is all about understand our body isn't ours. It's earth, air, fire, water. But we're not paying attention to it as earth, so it's hard for us to take care of our bodies. Yeah? Hence, we wonder, why do we need metta so much? Why are we so susceptible to it? Why do we need the Brahma Viharas so much? I wonder why we need that, right? It's like, you wonder why. How did we get like this? How did we get this disconnected from our bodies, from our emotions, right? Like from, and only wanting a deep sitting, but hating our loneliness. What is that? I wonder why we do that. The other day I mentioned how noisy the oyster catchers are. For those of you who don't know them, they're the black seabirds that have the long orange beaks. And if you don't know what they are, they're the loudest being down at the beach. They're so loud, it's amazing. And yesterday I had enough time to go for a little walk down the beach, and I was just kind of going along. I almost stepped on 5 oyster catchers were sleeping. I can't believe it. I mean, it was such a, I've been coming here since 1986 or something, and I've never seen it. I've only seen them as loud, kind of almost obnoxious, you know, sounding birds, but I love them. But it's like, here I'm going along, and it's like they're asleep. And they kind of opened their eye and kind of looked at me like, don't wake us up, honey. We're sleeping. But see, that's such a highlight. It's such a highlight. And it might mean that you might see an eagle swoop through the forest. It's such a highlight. Who can put words into it? But it makes life worth living. And it gives us the strength to go on. So the deepest meaning of the joy is that it's that joy can appear when we're with the pleasant or unpleasant. So the Buddha called it the gateway to awakening, also because it breaks the pleasure-pain syndrome. So if you are, and we've been hearing in the question and answer period, you can hear when people have that sense of a deep contentment or deep joy because they were with fear. It's so palpable. You can feel that, wow, that's so important that we don't have this idea that this joy or this contentment is based on just connecting with pleasure. Certainly the mudita is orienting the heart toward the happiness of ourselves and others. But as Steve said last night in his talk, that when the deepest Dhamma tears often come from when we feel like we've overcome a very difficult, that when we've related with skill, wisdom, and compassion, with something really, something that we never thought we could go through. And that's the Nautilus part of the talk. It's like, and then we have that much more space with that experience and less fear of it. More strength. I think I'll just end with a little story, just because I think it's a very simple, almost hard to grasp, but when I was on my self-retreat in my neighborhood, I don't tell people I'm on self-retreat, but slowly people over the years come up to me sometimes and they're like, are you in silence? It's really funny. I love it. But this guy that I'm telling you about, I don't even know him. He lives sort of across the way a bit. Getting old, the dermatologist is telling me, if I'm going to be on self-retreat out walking, which I don't do in my normal life, I don't go out in the middle of the day walking in Hawaii, you just don't, you know. But I bought this umbrella that has SPF, whatever, 50, you know, you're protected. And no one sees me with this umbrella except during self-retreat. So some people figure out I'm on self-retreat because I have my umbrella because I'm walking out there. And so there are times I'm very lazy about this sort of thing. I don't like carrying my umbrella, and I feel like people stare at me and it looks weird, but I carry my umbrella for a month out there during my retreat. And you know how sometimes you don't feel like you're having, I don't think anyone's noticing me. I'm out there for a month. So I'm walking along, end of my retreat, and I don't have my umbrella. It's the morning. Going along my merry way, and this white truck stops, rolls down the window, and this guy says, "So where's your umbrella?" I'm like, "What's it to you, buddy?" No, I didn't. I was like, I'm off my, you know, I didn't want to explain it. I said, "Okay, I'm lazy. I don't want to carry my umbrella every day." And he stops the car, and he said, "A month ago, I had a heart transplant, a full heart transplant, and they've discovered that when you have a heart transplant, you're more susceptible to skin cancer." And he said, "I've been watching you every day with your umbrella from my window while I'm in recovery." And I'm like, I'm finally getting inspired to carry an umbrella. And it was so interesting. It was like, wow. I walked away going, wow, he's been watching me do my walking. And, you know, who would know? Like, you don't know your impact. And actually, you know, it's so funny. Two more people in my neighborhood now are carrying umbrellas when they're walking. And it's good. It's actually good. The sun's dangerous for a lot of us as we get old. So, you know, I'm sharing this because I felt, after I kind of processed what he had said, it brought a lot of mudita. And now every time he drives by, he stops and we share sunscreen stories. And he even sometimes sprays me with his latest, you know, something or other. It's very interesting. You know, I don't even know his name. You know, and so this is the joy of life. This love tells me everything, and how we don't always know our impact, but every step has impact on the stars, on the trees, on your neighbor. So, apamada, carefulness. Let's sit for a minute.